Growing up, Mana Karazi often felt pulled between Iran, the place she was born, and the United States, where she's lived since she was a toddler.
It was this feeling of constantly loving these two identities and cultures that felt very naturally a part of me and a part of my identity, and yet getting these messages, whether it was from my teachers or parents of friends or, you know, just in the media, that somehow being Iranian was really bad.
The past few months have been particularly difficult for Karazi and other Iranian Americans as tensions have escalated between the U.S. and Iran.
It'll be obliteration like you've never seen before, but I'm not looking to do that.
The U.S. has been ramping up even more sanctions, and a disagreement over a downed U.S. drone almost led to a retaliatory strike by the Americans.
For those of us who grew up in the States, it's this idea of growing up and building our identity in a country that's constantly at risk of war or with increased tensions with this other place that we love and have so much family too.
Guive Mafrandereski came to the U.S. in 1971 as a college student, and he says the current uncertainty between Iran and the U.S. is worrisome.
The range of emotions that Iranians feel, both inside Iran and outside, you know, goes somewhere between complete indifference and like, what else is new? On the other hand, some of us basically fear that through some miscalculated action by one party or the other, we're going to end up having a situation where some 5,000 years of culture and territorial existence of a country comes under attack and just becomes complete rubble.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. We'll hear more from Karazi and Mufendereski in a few minutes. But first, we turn to Farnaz Fasihi for an update on the current situation between Iran and the U.S. Farnaz writes about Iran for the New York Times. Great to have you back on the show.
Thank you for having me back.
So we've been hearing so much about the back and forth between Iran and the U.S. Where do things stand today?
In the past few weeks, we've seen tensions escalate to a place where we were at the brink of war last week, where President Trump said that he had ordered a targeted attack on Iran in response to Iran's Revolutionary Guards downing over $100 million spy drone. And then he reversed that track. The U.S.'s policy seems to go back and forth between threatening, the president tweeted yesterday that he would obliterate Iran if it attacked another American target, and Iran saying that we will defend ourselves, that this is going to be very costly for America. So we have this kind of heated exchange, but at the same time, the U.S. saying that we really want to negotiate with Iran, and Mr. Trump saying that this can all go away if Iran comes to the negotiating table to talk about its nuclear deal, to talk about its missiles program and its regional policies. From Iran's perspective, they've also rejected any idea of speaking to the U.S. Today, the latest is that Ayatollah Khamenei, in response to Washington sanctioning him directly, said that the offer from the United States to negotiate is a trick, and the U.S. is afraid of our powers, and we would never negotiate with them. So this is kind of where we stand. Holding pattern, dangerously close to a conflict, and unpredictable reactions, really, from both sides.
We spoke to an Iranian-American yesterday about how they were feeling about the rhetoric. And I'm wondering, one of the things that they described was, particularly in response to President Trump's announcement and then pullback of the strike on Iran, is that it felt like psychological warfare. Farnaz, both sides are ramping up the rhetoric. Is it rhetoric, or are we really expecting a conflict at this point?
Just judging by what transpired in Washington, if indeed Mr. Trump ordered attack and then he reversed 10 minutes before, as he says, because generals at the Pentagon warned him that this will be a very costly war, I think despite the rhetoric, there are in both places voices and policymakers who understand the real risk of a conflict between Iran and the U.S. We also see from Iran's side that they say we will defend ourselves, but we don't really want war. So both sides have a subtitle of we don't really want war as the rhetoric escalates, because a war with Iran would likely involve not just Iran and the U.S., but Iran's proxies, the Shia militia Iran has trained in Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan, U.S. bases over there, and perhaps even either U.S. European allies or regional allies like Saudi Arabia. It would set a flame to a region that's already in chaos and potentially even destabilize oil prices and shipping insurance prices that go through the Strait of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf.
The U.S. strategy with Iran, as you mentioned earlier, feels somewhat disjointed. The U.S. is saying they want to continue negotiations with Iran, but they're also implementing sanctions. And Iran, I'm wondering if they have a cohesive strategy when it comes to the United States.
Iran does not have a cohesive strategy in that there are multiple layers of power in Iran. There's the supreme leader, which has rejected any negotiations with the U.S. There's the foreign minister, Javad Zarif, who's in favor of negotiations. There's the Revolutionary Guards, which operate semi-autonomously, definitely autonomously from the elected government, but in coordination with the supreme leader. So because there is no coherent power structure, there's no one power. Unlike North Korea, where Kim Jong-un has his hand and dictates power, in Iran, there are multiple voices and multiple layers of power. And this makes the situation even more fluid in terms of its response to the U.S.
There are some who have said that, particularly in light of the president's announcement and then pullback of potential strikes on Iran, that they're feeling somewhat of a deja vu to the beginnings of the Iraq War more than a decade ago. Are you seeing that?
I covered the Iraq War, the invasion, the context, what was happening before. Yes, it does remind, I think, reporters and analysts who were engaged with the Iraq War of the same thing, in that the U.S. is really trying to build a case why Iran is really dangerous, why Iran needs to be contained. We've seen op-eds that Iran has ties to al-Qaeda. We've seen opposition voices attacking American scholars, journalists, anybody who's opposed to war. On U.S. tax dollar, I don't know if you followed the whole Iran disinfo scandal, where actually State Department tax dollars were used by an entity called Iran Disinfo to attack Americans. So there's a lot of echoes of the Iraq War, but I actually think that's not a bad thing. That awareness is perhaps also helping accountability and raising questions so, the U.S. doesn't recklessly enter another war and get trapped for several more decades in the Middle East and spend trillions of dollars again without much result.
Farnaz Fasihi writes about Iran for The New York Times. Farnaz, thank you again.
Thank you for having me.
As tensions between the U.S. and Iran continue to escalate, we return to the stories of Geev Mufrendereski and Mana Karazi, two Iranian-Americans who came to the United States in the 70s and 80s. And they told me what it's like to live that duality today and to have your heart and your family in two countries.
I arrived in the United States in 1971 to attend Georgetown University. And when I arrived first in New York and later into Washington, D.C., it was a complete culture shock in terms of not only the physicality of the United States, but also the abundance of all sorts of amenities and the freedom that we all enjoyed in, that's very common to what our perception is of the United States. So that was those were the good times.
And can you tell our listeners what Iran was like in 1971?
Extremely hopeful. The oil exports had become a mainstay of the Iranian economy. There was progress in every direction, particularly in some social and cultural areas, women's rights and rights of workers and so on. And so the drumbeat to the future was one of attaining greater economic prosperity and one day hopefully greater political freedoms. And that coming out of the chaos of the 1950s, the post-war period, was pretty, kind of hopeful times for the country, and we were on the march.
And Mana, what about you? When did you come to the United States, and what prompted your journey?
My family came to the United States near the end of 1986, and I was a toddler at the time. I was born at the height of the Iran-Iraq war, and my dad actually was in the military under the Shah, so he had to leave. My family had already experienced the revolution and the trauma of the revolution and war, and I think that was when the largest population of Iranians left Iran, but it was really because of the conflict and, you know, the lack of clarity of what the future of the country would be.
What was the reception that you got when you arrived in the United States and people heard you were from Iran?
It was kind of mixed. At the one end of the spectrum, it was one of extreme hospitality. It's great. And people who had known Iran, who had traveled to Iran, and there have been enormous amount of exchanges back and forth between the Americans and Iranians in all line of work. And then there were, you know, people who always conflated the Iranians with the Arabs, and you know, we were called, you know, certain names, and which I don't deign repeating. And so it was kind of mixed, but overall I think it was extremely positive.
And Mana, what about you, having essentially come here as a toddler and growing up in the United States? What was your experience like when people would find out that you were from Iran and your family was Iranian?
Though I don't remember the 80s, I know that my parents and my siblings' experience definitely affected me, and I kind of grew up with their trauma and their baggage. So I remember, you know, like being at grocery stores or different places and my mom saying, "Don't tell anyone we're Iranian," or "Let's not speak Farsi in public," and having a lot of fear, I think, because of their experience after the hostage crisis and in the 80s at the height of the anti-Iranian sentiment. I'm the first in my family to grow up Iranian American and to really kind of have to define that identity for myself. And it was this feeling of constantly loving these two identities and cultures that felt very naturally a part of me and a part of my identity, and yet getting these messages, whether it was from my teachers or parents of friends or, you know, just in the media, that somehow being Iranian was really bad. I remember being in kindergarten and having my teacher actually tell me about the movie Not Without My Daughter, and that being my first lens into what people in the United States must think of my birth country.
I want to pivot a moment to more recent developments in the Iranian-United States relationship, Mana. After the Iran nuclear deal was passed, what was the reaction that you had and perhaps other Iranians that you know? Was it seen as a positive thing, negative thing?
I think for the majority, it was a moment of celebration and hope that somehow there would be more connections, less barriers between us and our families that we had that were still in Iran. And I think for a lot of our families in Iran, it was this moment of, okay, there's an opportunity for reform. There's going to be some economic growth. We can really change things. But there was a really beautiful period of time where I think we all were hopeful that things would shift and that Iranians within Iran would finally have an opportunity to have their own voice and not have others speak for them.
And of course, the Trump administration has since pulled out of the Iranian nuclear deal. Geev, when you heard that news, what was your reaction and the reaction perhaps of other Iranians that you know?
As an attorney, I just, and someone who believes in the sanctity of contracts, I was kind of baffled that a country who would just rip up an international agreement and say, well, we're going to take our ball and go home. And that to me was extremely disappointing from a practical standpoint as an attorney. As an American of Iranian descent, I just didn't think that that was going to be a very constructive way for the eventual rapprochement and normalization of relations between these two countries. And I was extremely disappointed. And come to think of it, maybe that 2015 nuclear deal just generated false hopes, too. It's very extremely disappointing.
Mana, what are your thoughts on that?
With the agreement, we had this hope that there was an opportunity and that things were going to change. But now we're just as vulnerable to the threat of war, if not more, than ever in my lifetime. And it's become cyclical, where my community is just regularly on the political chopping block, and we're so vulnerable. When I mentioned something about fearing the risk of war, Iranians in Iran quickly remind me that they're already experiencing economic war through the sanctions. And I think for those of us who grew up in the States, it's this idea of growing up and building our identity in a country that's constantly at risk of war or with increased tensions with this other place that we love and have so much family too.
You said that the economic sanctions are almost like an economic war. I'm wondering, Giv and Mana, what you're hearing from people who are still in Iran, whether they're friends or family, about how these sanctions are impacting their everyday lives.
You know, I think they're watching their currency depreciate on a regular basis. And I think those of us outside of the country are really fearful of war, and particularly in the last week or two have been really scared about it. But in Iran, they're just trying to continue to live their lives, because the truth is they've constantly been either through war or the threat of war. And this economic war is really devastating them. They're exhausted. They're watching shortages of various medications, and those of them who are more vulnerable to illness or have any sort of vulnerability as a human being in that country are particularly at risk right now, whether it's trying to get their diabetic or blood pressure medication or even complicated medications for cancer. They're in particular really at risk, but I think everyone's just exhausted and trying to survive and trying to live with this continued threat.
I guess the big question now is, given the current administration and even what we just heard last week about President Trump saying supposedly that he had called off a drone attack right before it was set to take place, the details on that are still emerging, to within a period of 24 hours to go from that to calling it off. What is the psychological and emotional impact of that, both for you all here in the United States and friends and family who are still in Iran? I mean, the dust doesn't appear to be settling, at least not at this point.
Well, it's huge. You don't know anymore what is the truth. And this whole thing about the drone strike and then the downing of the drone and the launching of military, operations against Iran, all of this basically being put out there and then pulled back. And it creates more than just anxiety. I mean, it puts you in a place where the only way you can cope with this is to disassociate yourself from reality and go about doing your daily business. You're constantly living with this fear of anticipation, and then nothing happens, and then something happens. This may be fun and games for someone who's sitting there in the White House and thinking this is the way they're going to have to interface with the world. But for the rest of us who get affected on a daily basis with this kind of stuff, this is not fun. This really isn't fun.
Yeah, I honestly feel like I haven't been able to catch my breath since Thursday. And I think that a lot of people in the U.S. in particular feel that way. I think for Iranians in Iran, for them, it's like, what's new? Like, we've always had this threat. I spent this weekend thinking about, my family is banned from coming to this country. They're experiencing sanctions. Now they're experiencing the threat of strikes. And there's nothing I can do. I'm an American citizen, and I have very little power in being able to do anything about this. And I spent the weekend thinking about, you know, like, if there were strikes on Thursday, like, is my family ready to leave? Can they get visas to go anywhere else? How many can I actually save? And the answer is, you know, very little. Because even the family that I do have that lives in Iran, like, their currency is depreciating at a rate where it's not really worth very much anymore for them to be able to even sustainably leave. And the idea that there could potentially be, you know, a huge influx of refugees from Iran if something were to happen, and all of us sitting in this country feeling complicit in a war we don't want. How do you live on a daily basis knowing that there's a possibility that your family is going to be attacked, that you have no way of being able to help them? You know, like, am I going to, for the rest of this administration, have to try to bring it up at dinner parties? Can I just randomly bring it up in conversation and say, hey, by the way, I'm Iranian. There's a possibility that our country is about to be hitting Iran. We need to do something. And it feels very disempowering right now.
Monica Razi is the executive director of Iranian Alliances Across Borders, and Guy Mufendereski is an attorney in Massachusetts. Thanks to you both for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.